Welcome, learners, to another deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we're peeling back the layers on a command that seems, you know, incredibly straightforward. Do not murder.
Right. Seems simple.
But it holds just astonishing depth. We've gathered some, well, really fascinating sources for this. We've got classic literature, ancient law codes.
And some profound biblical texts, too. It's quite a mix.
Exactly. So our mission, really, for this deep dive is to unearth those surprising nuggets of insight hiding in there. We're going beyond just what it prohibits, right? We want to explore why it's so fundamental and, you know, how its meaning has evolved, deepened over millennia.
Yeah, the evolution is key.
Get ready for some aha moments. I think this might challenge how you think about a really basic human principle.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's kick things off with something maybe a bit unexpected. A chilling thought experiment from H.G. Wells' The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Ah, Moreau. Classic and pretty dark.
Right. Imagine this scientist transforming animals into something. Well, almost human, these man animals.
They walk. They talk.
They try to reason, but they're constantly, you know, teetering on the edge, always in danger of reverting back to their primal, beastly state.
It's a precarious existence, he paints.
Totally. And the central law given to these creatures by this strange goat-turned Moses figure he creates is thou shalt not kill. But here's where it gets really interesting, kind of twisted.
Okay.
While that was their main law, if a man animal broke any rule, like if they slipped back into truly beastly behavior,
what happened?
The others were basically compelled to kill them, to execute them.
Wow. So the rule against killing is enforced by killing.
Exactly. It wasn't really about not killing in an absolute sense, but about control through killing. It's this disturbing kind of self-defeating paradox.
Yeah, that's Wells for you. What's fascinating there is that Wells, you know, he was a humanist, a deep thinker. He wasn't just commenting on animals.
Right, he was looking at us.
He was holding up a mirror to human nature. His argument, essentially, was that laws are this thin veneer, maybe the only thing separating us from our primal instincts.
Just a thin line.
Yeah, restraining the brute that lurks inside each one of us, as he put it. Without laws, he suggested, we'd just revert, hunt and kill our own kind.
It's a pretty bleak assessment, isn't it?
It is. Quite depressing, if you ask me.
It is stark. And you could argue history shows flashes of that pretty clearly. But what do you think might be missing from Wells's view there? Or maybe what was he overlooking? If he sees humanity as just, you know, one step away from being beasts held back by rules, does the Bible offer a different starting point? Different reason for why this command even exists?
That's an excellent question. Because the Bible offers, well, a definite counter-narrative.
Okay.
It insists humans are fundamentally more than just, you know, two-legged animals held in check by rules.
More than just restrained beasts.
Exactly. It posits that we have an inherent, a divine nature within us, that we reflect the image of God.
The image of God.
And that, the Bible argues, is the very reason we get the command. You shall not murder. It's an internal reason stemming from our nature, not just an external rule to keep the beast caged.
Okay, that's a very different foundation. So if Wells highlights our potential for brutality, let's jump back, way back.
To the beginnings.
Yeah, to the very first written laws. How did societies then grapple with this? Because regulations about murder, they seem as old as society itself.
They really are. If you zoom out, the bigger picture is, as soon as people started living in groups, they had to figure this out.
Define the lines.
Define the boundaries. Who could be killed? Who couldn't? It was critical for just basic survival and order. And get this. The very first law in the law code of Irinamu.
From Sumer. Way back.
Yeah, Sumer. Around 2050 BC. The very first law states it simply. If a man commits murder, that man will be killed.
Wow. Law number one.
Right there at the top. Bam.
So right from the get-go, this prohibition was foundational. Not something that sort of evolved later.
Exactly. And the consistency across ancient cultures is pretty striking. You look at the much later law code of Hammurabi from Babylon.
Around 1750 BC.
Yep. And the Middle Assyrian law code, maybe 1450, 1250 BC, they all just assume murder is a capital offense. It seems to be this common stream running through human society.
Blah.
Murderers deserve to forfeit their own life.
A universal understanding, almost.
Seems like it.
It's important to note, though, that thou shalt not kill wasn't a clearly not a blanket ban on all killing, even back then.
No, absolutely not. That's a crucial distinction.
There were specific circumstances where killing was, well, not just okay, but expected, right?
Definitely. We see these careful exceptions, these circumscriptions, throughout ancient Near Eastern law codes. War, for instance.
Right, expected.
Not only expected, but often encouraged, you know, killing the enemy. Then there's execution carried out by judicial authorities. Another clear exception.
State-sanctioned killing.
Right. And this also brings up the whole question of blood feuds, where an offended family felt they had not just a right, but maybe even a responsibility to kill the person who killed their relative, to avenge the death.
Ah, vengeance.
Yeah. And it wasn't just murder that carried the death penalty back then. Lots of other crimes did, too.
Like what?
Well, we've seen this in other deep dives. Striking or even, you know, sassing your parents could sometimes warrant death.
Seriously.
Yeah. Some property crimes, too, like stealing from a temple your life was forfeit, or vengeance for personal injury, like if a man seduced another man's wife.
What happened then?
Both could potentially be put to death. These codes often had this sense of balance, the lex talionis, eye for an eye.
Like the nose example.
Exactly, like cutting off a man's nose if his wife's nose was cut off. Yeah. So while you might state an absolute principle, like don't kill, there was always this expectation of, well, a clear set of exceptions.
Okay, so my teenage self definitely wouldn't have survived back then. Puts tough love in perspective.
Chuckles slightly. Well, probably not.
But let's get to the heart of it now, this specific wording. You shall not kill or you shall not murder. The original Hebrew is, you said, absolutely crucial here.
It really is. The Hebrew verb used in the commandment, in the Ten Commandments, is ratzak.
Ratzak. Yeah.
Now, this is not the common sort of generic word for killing in Hebrew.
Yeah.
That would be kanel.
Okay, so different words.
Very different. Ratzak has really specific, powerful connotations.
Such as?
Well, for one, ratzak is only used for killing people.
Ah, so all those debates about vegetarianism?
Nope. Has absolutely nothing to do with animals or being vegetarian.
Yeah.
Ratzak refers exclusively to personal acts of murder or perhaps manslaughter.
Personal acts. Got it.
And here's the kicker. It's never used for killing in war.
Never.
Never. And it's never used for official acts of execution carried out by the state or judicial authorities.
Wow.
It's laser focused on the unlawful personal taking of human life. That distinction alone, understanding Ratzak, it really reshapes how you understand the command.
So it's not a blanket don't kill anything or even don't kill any person under any circumstance. It's very specifically, don't commit this type of killing.
Exactly. This unlawful personal act.
That's a huge clarification.
Mm.
And you mentioned the Bible goes deeper than just that one precise word. It fills out the command with other crucial distinctions.
It does. You see this clearly in Exodus, for example. There's a clear distinction made, much like in our modern law, between an intentional death and an accidental one.
Intent matters.
Hugely. The text says something like, anyone who strikes a person with a fatal blow is to be put to death. Standard murder. But
yes,
if it was not done intentionally, but God lets it happen, basically an accident, then they are to flee to a place that I will designate. This is pointing towards the later idea of the cities of refuge.
Okay, safe haven for accidental killing.
Right. However, if someone schemes and kills someone deliberately with premeditation,
then what?
Then they are to be taken, even from the altar, and put to death. Intent is paramount.
That distinction between accidental and deliberate is key.
Absolutely. And what's truly, I think, revolutionary here, especially for its time, is the radical equality presented in biblical law regarding murder.
How so?
Well, in other ancient law codes we've talked about, the penalty often depended on who killed whom. You know, a slave killing a slave versus a nobleman killing a peasant.
Different penalties based on status.
Right. Might have very different outcomes, different fines, maybe not even death. But in these biblical laws, there's generally no distinction regarding class or status when it comes to murder.
Really?
If a person has killed a person, all life is regarded as being of equal value. That's a profoundly different, almost audacious perspective for the ancient world. All human life is sacred.
That is powerful. A statement about the inherent value of life, regardless of station. Now, you also mentioned the avenger of blood.
Mm.
A victim's family having the responsibility to exact vengeance.
Yes.
That sounds,
well,
like a recipe for endless conflict, doesn't it?
It absolutely was, or could be. If you connect that to the bigger picture, it could easily lead to these really long, drawn-out, perpetuated cycles of violence. Think, you know, the Hatfields and McCoys, famous feuds.
Right. Tit-for-tat violence spiraling out of control.
Exactly. And this is precisely why the Bible introduced the concept of the cities of refuge.
Ah, so that connects back to the accidental killing point.
Precisely. If someone accidentally killed another person, they could flee to one of these designated cities. There, they'd be protected from the Avenger of Blood.
Breaking the cycle.
Breaking the cycle, preventing these endless feuds. Manslaughter, accidental killing, was specifically not a capital offense if it was truly accidental. Murder, though.
Intentional murder.
Yes. That required the texts talk about malice and forethought, essentially.
Yeah.
Very similar to our modern concept of first-degree murder. That was still a capital crime, refuge or no refuge.
Okay, so the laws provided nuance.
Yeah.
Intent, equality, even mechanisms like cities of refuge to prevent cycles of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned earlier, the Bible gives a why.
Mm-hmm.
Other codes assume you shouldn't kill, maybe for societal order. But the Bible offers this powerful transcendent reason. What is that fundamental reason?
The rationale, the deep why, is found right near the beginning in Genesis.
Okay.
After the flood narrative, God says, "Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind."
In the image of God.
Exactly. While the immediate context there in Genesis 9 is actually about animals killing people, the principle extends directly and forcefully to human-on-human murder. We are forbidden to ratzak, to murder, because we must respect the image of God.
In our fellow human beings.
In every single human being. Our brothers and sisters. It really boils down to that inherent sacred value, that divine reflection.
That concept. It really shifts everything, doesn't it? From just a rule to keep order to a profound statement about human dignity.
Absolutely.
And then Jesus comes along. And he takes this commandment, already profound, and stretches its meaning in this, well, truly radical way, using hyperbole, you said, to make his point stick.
He really does. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus declares something astonishing. He says, basically, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder.' But I tell you..."
Yeah, what does he tell them?
"That everyone who is angry with his brother shall be answerable to the court."
Just being angry makes you answerable.
It gets stronger. "Whoever says to his brother, 'Raka,'" which was a common Aramaic insult, sort of like "you good for nothing," found in the Talmud.
Okay, an insult?
"Shall be answerable to the Supreme Court. And whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell."
Wow. That's intense. So what's the deeper principle here? He can't mean you'll literally be hauled into court just for feeling angry, right? He's pushing past the physical act itself.
Exactly. He's not setting up new legal precedents for anger management. He's driving home the root issue. The reason why we shouldn't murder, which is that profound respect for a person's inherent God-given value.
So calling someone names connects to that.
Yes. To call someone raka, worthless, or a fool, moron. It's not just a minor insult about something they did. It attacks their personhood, their very dignity, their worth as someone made in God's image. It's trying to strip them of that value.
It's a verbal assault on their being, not just their behavior.
Precisely. And that raises this really important question. If not murdering is the absolute bare minimum standard.
The floor.
Right, the floor. Jesus calls us to the maximum, to actively honor, cherish, lift up the image of God we see in every single person.
That reminds me of C.S. Lewis.
Ah, yes. Lewis famously said something like, "We should treat every person we encounter as a potential immortal splendor or a horror, basically as a potential spiritual giant."
Because that divine image is in everyone.
It remains in every person, however distorted or hidden it might seem by sin or circumstance. And that image, that potential, deserves our respect, even our reverence.
And since Jesus directly links murder, or the root of it, to anger, let's unpack that a bit. How should we handle this really powerful emotion? It seems anger itself isn't always wrong.
That's a critical point. Anger is complex. We can definitely distinguish between, say, good, neutral, and bad anger.
Okay, good anger. How can anger be good?
Well, good anger is often anger on behalf of others. Righteous indignation. It spurs us towards justice. Think of the passion behind the civil rights movement. Anger at injustice.
Right, motivating change.
Or even Jesus clearing the temple. He was angry, offended by the dishonor shown to his father's house, the exploitation happening there. This kind of anger is motivating, focused outward on fixing a wrong.
Okay, so that's good anger. What about neutral anger?
Neutral anger is more like, well, the natural reaction to daily frustrations. You get caught off in traffic, your computer crashes.
Mm-hmm.
You feel a flash of anger. It's an emotion. It's not necessarily virtuous or evil in itself. The real question is what you do with it.
Right. How you respond.
Exactly. Does it fester? Does it lead to harmful actions or words? Or do you manage it?
Okay. And then bad anger.
Bad anger is when we move from being angry about what somebody has done to being angry about who somebody is.
Ah, that's the shift Jesus was warning about.
Precisely. This includes anger based on someone's race or religion or their wealth or poverty or things fundamentally beyond their control or just part of who they are. This kind of anger easily bleeds over into hatred, as one commentary put it.
And hatred is always condemned.
Always condemned in the Bible. Do not hate your neighbor in your heart, Leviticus says. Instead, love your neighbor as yourself. Bad anger attacks the person, their inherent worth, the image of God in them. It chips away at that foundation.
That reminds me, funny story, I was driving with my 4-year-old once, got cut off and muttered, you know, what a jerk,
right,
under my breath. And my son pipes up from the backseat, completely serious. Daddy, don't you mean what they did was kind of a jerky thing to do?
Chuckles out of the mouths of babes.
Right. Even a 4-year-old got the distinction. We shouldn't paint people with the brush of one action. To call someone a fool or a jerk is to judge their entire character, their being, not just comment on their action.
That's a perfect illustration. It's exactly the distinction Jesus is making, connecting it back to the ultimate violation, murder, because it stems from the same root, devaluing the person.
Denying that image of God.
Absolutely. When we fall into that bad anger, that judgmental labeling, we're essentially denying or devaluing that divine spark in another person. Mm-hmm. And that's fundamentally what the command, do not murder, in its deepest sense, is designed to protect.
So, wrapping up this deep dive,
mm-hmm.
we've journeyed from H.G. Wells's bleak view through ancient laws like Ur-Nammu and Hammurabi.
Unpack the crucial Hebrew word ratzak.
Explore the biblical nuances of intent, equality, those cities of refuge.
Mm.
Landed on the powerful why, the image of God.
And then saw how Jesus radically extended the command to our deepest attitudes, linking anger and contempt to the root of murder.
Yeah. It's been quite the journey for a seemingly simple command.
The core takeaway, I think, is that this command is about so much more than just avoiding physical harm. It's really a profound affirmation of the inherent sacred value of every single human life, precisely because each person bears that divine image.
It's a positive affirmation, not just a negative prohibition.
Exactly. And it challenges us then to move beyond the mere absence of murder to something much more active. Active respect, honor, maybe even love for our neighbors. And that starts by managing our internal world, our anger, our judgments.
So as you, our listeners, go about your day, maybe consider this. If the essence of do not murder is truly about respecting the divine image in every person, where might you, perhaps unintentionally, be denigrating personhood?
Yeah.
Maybe through your words, or even just your thoughts or attitudes.
That's a challenging thought.
And following that, what small step could you take today, maybe, to consciously choose instead to honor and cherish that divine image in someone you encounter? Perhaps even, especially, in someone you find difficult?
A powerful question to reflect on.